And welcome back to Fully Equipped, Golf.com's gear-focused podcast, where we take weekly PGA Tour news and break it down for golfers of all skill levels. I'm Tim Brion, Executive Vice President of TruSpec Golf, joined by Managing Editor for Equipment for Golf.com, Jonathan Wall, and Senior Equipment Editor for Golf.com as well, Andrew Tursky. Gentlemen, PGA week.
Major week, baby.
Who you got? Jay Walt?
I'm taking X. Xander Schauffele.
Ooh,
West X. Coast kid.
Ooh. Do people call him X?
I do.
I like it. We got to get that to stick.
Andrew?
X going to give it to you.
Well, I picked Victor.
Victor Hovland.
To be victorious this week in our gambling pool.
He's burned me so many times this year, but I still keep taking him.
I like what I saw last week out of Brooks, man. And I think the sense of history on the line, I don't know if he's going to rise to the occasion and get the W, but I think he's going to play well. And so I think he's got as good a chance as anybody out there. So I'm not typically a Brooks guy, but he played well last week. Hopefully there's not too much scar tissue from that tee shot on 18.
I think he plays well with a chip on his shoulder,
though. 100%. I think when they asked him about his confidence level in that press conference, that kind of got him going a little bit. So
it's funny. We saw him driving in the water on 18 last week, and now this week he's got a new driver in the bag. Is there correlation?
New/old.
We'll get into that in a little bit later in the pod, but we've got a lot of content teed up for this week. A lot of tour news going into a major, more than I would expect. Usually these guys try to reach a point of stability going into a major, but we see some folks making some changes over the last couple weeks that are worth getting into. As mentioned earlier, gear spotlight. We're going to feature the TaylorMade M5 this week. There's some news coming out of Brooks regarding that. And it has a cool feature, you know, that was introduced a couple years ago that I hadn't seen in a lot of club design before that. We've got a 3-wood question for mailbag this week coming out of W_Murphy on Instagram. And then we've got a really cool interview later on. Somebody a little bit outside of our normal scope. Usually we're interviewing tour players or teachers or club designers or notable people in the equipment side of the industry. We went a little bit outside of our normal interview guest this week, and we ended up getting Ray Allen on the pod. Ray's a really good golfer, so that's why, you know, we thought he would lend some value being a really accomplished amateur player. So we're really looking forward to that.
He brought the heat.
Yeah, man, it was a great interview. He's
oh my gosh, he did not go there.
Andrew,
you got to sneak him in when he can.
We're going to put you on timeout if you keep that up. So let's get into topic number one, which I think, you know, Jay Wall, I think you caught this yesterday. Is the GOAT using something a little different for the putter?
Yeah, using something a little different.
We don't know if he's gaming it yet, right? But he's just testing.
Well, I saw pictures from today, Tim, and he still has the putter in hand. So
I think that's
a sign that he's strongly considering
hours.
It. I haven't seen. You know, granted, neither myself nor Tursky are on site due to again with COVID right now. They're capping the number of journalists that are going to be able to go to the majors, and we're only getting one for the PGA. So just going based off the photos, but yeah, still has the putter in play. It is a little bit different. You know, it's still a Newport 2. It's called, the official name for this putter is Scotty Cameron Newport 2 Timeless prototype. Now the Timeless is the super high end stuff that Scotty usually rolls out. We're talking, you know, $10,000 plus. You know, this is GSS, the German stainless steel that Tiger had been using, but this putter is a little bit different because it has adjustable heel, toe, tungsten sole weights. So, if you remember back to the Open Championship last year, Tiger actually tested this putter in addition to his usual gamer. But his gamer had a bunch of lead tape caked into the cavity. And the reason for that was because poor rush, you know, in the Open Championship, I should say, in general, greens are typically on the slower side.
Right.
And it's been known, Tiger has done this in the past, where he's jammed lead tape in there to try and increase the head weight of his putter. And that's just to kind of try and help on those slower greens. I haven't heard any of the players talking about green speed this week, so I'm not quite sure if that's why Tiger is testing this putter. But it is kind of curious that he's going to something with the adjustable weights.
I think it's his slow green putter for sure. And well, he still has the pin grip on there for all those that were concerned.
That's where I was going to go. I'd want to know the head weight, and I'd want to know the head weight features to it, and then I'd also want to know a little bit about the loft of the putter. Is the loft
lofted? His typical putter is 327 grams. It's
pretty light to begin
head
with.
Weight. You know, yeah, very light to begin.
I would say you probably couldn't find a retail 327 gram head, you know, walking in.
Right, so that would lead me to believe that if Tiger's using adjustable weights, you know, today's typical, you know, putters that are out there, 330 is about as light as you're going to find. So I would guess that this is heavier than what he's accustomed to using. So I do. I think
it's definitely pretty light from when I know Wall has held the putter. I don't know if Timmy B has held it.
I've held it.
Okay. All right.
Tried to get one in on me.
I did. I thought there was no way that you've held.
So we've all held the Elder Wand.
I'd bet that the head weight's a lot heavier. What does that do? Obviously, unless you add weight underneath the grip or the handle, that's going to increase swing weight. What's the intention of having a heavier head weight? The intention is, you know, force equals MA, mass times acceleration. So if you're accelerating the putter, the pace of the stroke is the same, and you got more mass down at the end of it. The idea is it's gonna cause the ball to come off the face a little bit quicker in some cases. So that could be one of the plays here. A heavier swing weight for some players may decrease rate of closure, may leave the face a little bit more open. So maybe he's having an issue with the face closing too much, and maybe pulling some putts. Go with heavier weight, maybe that helps. If there's a difference in the loft. The loft is something that you would target if you're playing on a specific, you know, course condition as far as your greens. If I'm playing on really grainy, shaggy, you know, not as well manicured Bermuda, if I'm playing on Seaside Poena, that really has, you know, those seed heads that'll pop up on Poena, anything where I need to launch the ball up in the air a little bit higher, you know, when the grass is a little bit, when the greens are a little bit slower, grass is shaggier, sometimes you want to, you know, launch the ball higher. So there could be a lot at play here. I'm sure the spec is almost identical as far as length.
I can't see him changing any of that.
Yeah, lie angle the same. I'm sure the lie angle is the same. The only real difference I would bet here is head weight, possibly swing weight, and then possibly loft. Obviously, a lot of this is speculation, but that's interesting to see him switch. My question would be is we haven't seen him in action in a while. So how long's this one been in play? Has it been in play, you know, down at Medalist for quite a while?
I would guess yes. You know, he talked about that at Memorial. That he said the one thing that he struggled with was his putter. He just said that he was so used to playing on just different greens down there, and he was used to trying to you know, basically look at these putts that maybe had a couple feet of break. And now he was looking at these big swingers, and he was really having trouble kind of matching up his location with the pace. And so that was one of the things that he was going to try and work on, he said, when he was off. So, yeah, I would guess that if this putter is still in the bag on Wednesday, that he's been working with it a lot at home.
What are the odds that the cherry bomb is in the hotel room right now?
100% he has it with him.
100% it made the trip.
Yeah, he probably didn't know which putter he was going to use until he saw the green speed.
100% that it made the trip.
Yeah,
I agree.
For sure.
He'd be foolish not to bring that with him at least.
So, well, that'll be interesting to see how that plays out throughout the week as far as his putting on those greens with the new putter. You know, no guarantee that it actually gets in the bag as far as, you know, he games it in the event, but. With everything you guys have seen over the last couple of days, it seems like there's a pretty good chance. So, you know, last week there was some content that came out regarding Justin Thomas's wedges, and obviously very relevant topic considering that he was able to get the victory on Sunday. You know, kind of an interesting idea. Aaron Dill released some information about when Justin refreshes his wedges and puts new ones in the bag, about some of, you know, there's a little bit of strategy as far as how he does it. J-Wall, what did you hear on this?
Yeah, no, I saw AD post something on Instagram, and so I reached out and chatted with him a little bit last week. And, you know, it's interesting because we look at tour players, and when it comes to their wedges, we think, well, these guys, I mean, they got all their stuff for free. So they're probably changing out their wedges pretty regularly. And Aaron mentioned something that was interesting, you know, groove management, which is something you normally don't really hear about, but a lot of tour players do take a really close look at their grooves and kind of how they're wearing down throughout the season. And I wanted just to kind of bring this back to the average golfer. You know, what can they learn from what JT does? Which, you know, JT, like a lot of tour pros, he changes out the lob wedge about every 6 weeks. And that's usually on a pretty regular cadence with the majors. You know, you want really sharp grooves to make sure that drop and stop with those, you know, 60 degrees. But
this, folks, so your point you just mentioned there, J-Wall, I think there's one thing to note before you continue. And this is why these guys that are really good grinders are so darn good, because what the average golfer doesn't understand is these folks are replacing their lob wedge every 6 weeks, and sometimes even quicker than that.
But normal people can't do that. So we can't afford to buy.
So the grinds that they put on, the grinds that they put on a wedge, they have to be able to replicate them so many times. It's not like you're going to produce a grind on a wedge 1 year and then you don't have to worry about replicating it until next year. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to do it 7, 8, 9 times in a year, something that you made back in January as far as the shaping and the geometry of the sole. You're going to have to be able to replicate it exactly. You'll hear this a lot out of tour players. This guy's really amazing at replicating the same grind over and over and over. Like, that's why Mike Taylor has this magic quality about him. And then you have other guys that can still put great grinds on a wedge, but they can't replicate it every single time. There's something that's slightly different. So I did want to just kind of highlight that, because I think that that's something that the average golfer misses when they're talking about the quality of the craftsmanship of some of these folks. So much of it goes into their ability to repeat the grind piece after piece after piece.
Yeah.
But you were saying
that's a really good point. So the 60 degree, you know, changed out pretty regularly. And you think about tour pros, they're playing a lot more than the average golfer. So every 6 weeks, you know, that makes sense for a tour pro. But when it comes to the pitching wedge, because JT uses a Vokey pitching wedge instead of using one from his set. And then he also has a Vokey gap wedge. Those two, he'll typically go anywhere from 12 to 24 months without changing them out. And, you know, it's important to note that JT has something that maybe some average golfers don't, which is a lot of speed, and that's one thing that Aaron pointed out is, you know, the reason that Justin can get away with going 12 to 24 months without changing out his pitching wedge or his gap wedge is because he has a ton of speed. He's able to wear in that sweet spot on those wedges, and he doesn't have to worry so much about spin, because look, spin with those two clubs doesn't matter as much as it does with a lob wedge. And again, the speed also is a really important factor, but I did think it was interesting that, you know, you've got a guy who changes out the lob wedge every 6 weeks, but when it comes to those other two wedges, he can go upwards of 2 years without breaking one in.
And there's a little bit of a tell going on there too, as far as the way he uses those wedges. So his pitching wedge and his gap wedge, I bet you he's not using for a lot of stuff around the greens, and I bet you he's not using it out of the rough and pitching. Some guys like to pitch with gap wedges. I know that when I added a gap wedge to my set, I found it very useful to pitch the ball with. And some players may not like to pitch with a gap wedge. They may prefer to pitch with a lob wedge or a sand wedge as kind of the standard club that they use. So if you're somebody that's taking a lot of pitch shots with a gap wedge, well, you're going to need some grooves because you don't have enough speed to generate the friction needed or the spin needed to be able to get the desirable outcome as far as when the ball hits the green. So I think your use case is important here, what you're using your gap wedge for. Now, if you're hitting three-quarter shots, you can, you know, that's enough speed to generate enough spin where it's probably okay to have, you know, a less aggressive groove configuration. But if you're using it for shots right around the green, shots out of the rough a lot, you probably do want to have, you know, an aggressive groove that's maintained, meaning that's fairly fresh. I've heard stories, and you see a lot of variation here, and you guys can attest to this when it comes to groove or wedge replacement. I've heard stories of VJ replacing every week. I've heard of stories of other guys replacing every week. And then I've heard stories of guys, you know, having a couple of sets that they kind of go in rotation. And they will actually, you know, they'll actually regroove the golf club after one round of life. So I've heard all sorts of crazy stuff here when it comes to, you know, guys, what guys are doing on tour with their wedges. Pretty safe to say, though, that most guys are replacing every couple months. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. That's pretty accurate. Every time we talk about wedge grooves, I just think about McCord, about him going to the wedge guy behind the castle door.
Yeah, behind the castle door, and nobody told him that he needed to knock the groove lip down before he went out and played with it. Yeah. He's sucking balls off the green. And that was an amazing one.
Oh, my God.
Who was it that whispered in his ear, hey, I know you went and saw the groove guy?
I think it was...
Was it George Archer? I don't know.
Littler?
I don't know, man, but it was...
I think it was Littler. Yeah, yeah. I think Tursky's right. Yeah, it was somebody who's a major winner.
For all of our listeners that missed those McCord pods, you got to go back and check them out.
I would definitely go back because they're worth it. They're timeless.
They're some of those stories. Such great stories. They're amazing. With that, let's get into... And well, last piece to close out that topic. You're exactly right, like speed. You're a high-speed, high-spin guy. You can suffer lower spin on your gap and pitching wedge. If you're not creating the launch and you're not hitting, if you're not a high ball hitter that generates a lot of spin, if you don't have the ability with a full swing to stop a pitching wedge right where it lands, then you probably need the grooves on your pitching wedge. Mm-hmm. You don't want less. So
yeah, I mean, a guy like JT, he probably doesn't even want sharp grooves on his pitching wedge and gap wedge because he'd suck it right off the green.
Exactly right.
He usually breaks in his like a fresh gap or pitching. He'll break it in at home for a while to kind of get it worn in just a bit, kind of like you would a new baseball glove. You wouldn't put a brand new glove right off the rack on and go play. You're gonna break it in a little bit before you take it out.
Gotta put it in the microwave. New baseball.
But the lob wedge, I bet the lob wedge is not gonna get broken in. The lob wedge is gonna go in when it's super fresh. I mean, he's gonna hit a couple shots to make sure that the bounce and the grind are exactly what he wants to feel, make sure that the build feels correct, but once he's validated the club that it's built correctly and the same as the previous one he played, that's gonna probably go right in the bag.
Sure.
Next thing to get into this last week was Tommy Fleetwood has joined the hybrid revolution. Interesting one here. I mean, to start 2020, to think all of these higher speed players would end up with hybrids in the bag.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, I would qualify it as a movement at this point.
I was on record as saying that all the hybrids would be out of play within a month, and more and more guys are just throwing it in. So it hurts to be wrong, but that's big. That's big of me to admit it.
We don't mind it.
It's big of me.
J-Wall and I don't mind it. It's okay. You can keep it up.
I don't want to make a habit of being wrong. But.
No, but I mean, it's so many of them at this point.
Yeah.
And I would say it's a movement at this point. You know, for all you amateur players out there, all you listeners that have been hesitant towards moving to hybrids because you wanted to, maybe there was some vanity and ego in there. Well, I think you can disregard that at this point.
And it's young guys, too. It's not like the older guys.
Yeah, so... You know? So when's a hybrid going in your bag, Tursky?
I want to say it'll never happen, but I don't know. Clearly, I'm wrong about hybrids.
But I
hit big draws. I don't know if a hybrid's the right club for me. You've seen me hit
some of them. Some of them are less, you know, hook and pull biased than others. You know, through lie angle, offset, CG, all the above. Some of them aren't as draw biased, and that's why you see some tour players going to it. I know this next week, Saturday, Sunday, we'll spend some time with Kevin Chappell, and we're testing hybrids. So, you know, it's gotten to the point where...
I got to come watch that session.
Kevin's never really entertained a hybrid before. It's been a utility iron or a 5-wood. It's actually a 6-wood. It's kind of a 5-wood cut down and has some hot melt in the back to make it fly high, so it kind of acts like a 6-wood. But he's never really been a guy that's been... into wanting to test hybrids.
So why is he testing now? Because he sees everyone throwing them in?
100%.
Really?
He's got an itch to scratch now.
Isn't that funny? That's how PGA Tour players go. I mean, that's how you are with your buddies. You know, you see a guy play well one week. It's like, oh, what's in his bag? What'd he change?
Yeah.
And then you want to play it too.
Listen, the curiosity's there. And that's one of the great things about, you know, when you're with a setup like Kevin's with now where he's working with us, it's great because... he can scratch that itch. And it doesn't mean that he's obligated to play anything or, you know, it doesn't matter. At this point, we're just going to go out, test it, and see what happens. And maybe we end up with a hybrid in play the next time he tees it up, you know, which will be in a few weeks here. So we'll see. But
are we going to talk about Tommy Fleetwood?
Yeah. So hybrid, that's exactly what I was just going to say. What did he put in?
So, yeah, Fleetwood's an interesting one because he's always struggled with one distance in his bag. And he started to notice that it's starting to creep into his par five scoring. And that's the yardage from about 235 to 250 for him.
Yeah. That's no man's land for a lot of players, right?
Yeah, it is. And that's kind of what's happened. He's got a TaylorMade 5-wood, but he hits a 265. And then he has a 4-iron, a Srixon Z785 4-iron in the bag. And you know, he's hitting that, you know, maybe 225, but it's tough because you've got, like you said, that no man's land in there. And Fleetwood, one thing he does not like to do is he does not like to finesse the ball with a 5-wood. So to go from 265 down to 235, you know, that's tough sledding, especially in tournament golf, to try and do that. So, you know, one of the things that they decided to try was a hybrid, a 22-degree TaylorMade SimMax Rescue, which, you know, the SimMax Rescue is the one that we've seen DJ, Morikawa. We also saw who else has used
that? Say Rory?
Rory.
McIlroy. I mean, it's been a very popular option for a lot of their guys. And Fleetwood's not on staff with anybody. He's brand agnostic. And so they went to a 22-degree, opened up the face to 20.75, and he's able to hit a 235, and he's able to ramp it up a little bit if he needs to, and even if he needs to dial it back just a touch without having to really take his foot off the gas, he can do that as well. They strengthened his 5-iron, for those who were curious, because he removed the 4-iron. They strengthened it a little bit to get it to 215 yards just to try and kind of close those gaps up a little bit. And, he's got in the bag now, and that's, you know, the one club that he's hopeful will help him with his par five scoring.
Makes a lot of sense to me. And that 230 to 250 is typically the no man's land for most of these folks. And for all you listeners out there, I think it's important to understand that even at the PGA Tour level, they don't have a club for every single distance usually. There's somewhere in that spread between a 3-wood and your shortest wedge, there's somewhere in there that you're going to have to make some sacrifices. And most folks are willing to make that sacrifice in that 230 to 250 range just because they don't have a lot of shots that are struck from that area. But you do run into course-dependent situations where what happens when you have a par 3 that's 240? Well, you're not going to take it easy on a 5-wood. Like, feathering a 5-wood is difficult.
And I would say for most amateurs, like, don't even worry about that distance, honestly. But it's almost more worthwhile to put in, like, another wedge.
But here's the takeaway, is that ultimately there is probably a gap somewhere in their set. Let's call it maybe 190 to 210, where a 3-wood goes 210 in the air, but a 3 hybrid or a 5-iron or 4-iron goes, you know, 180. Mm-hmm. And so what do they do in that? They're going to have a no man's land in there too. It's just not going to be at that same distance. Instead of 230 to 250, it'll be scaled down to like 190 to 210. We see this a lot. So what do they do there? Well, they've got to spend some time with a fitter, or at least get some time on technology to understand carry distance, and then make a decision based upon your course that you play, like par 3 yardages. If you play a home course that has 195-yard par 3, you better have something you can hit between 187 and 203. Otherwise, you're going to be giving away a shot every time you play that hole. So that would be my recommendation out to the average golfer out there.
So here's a question, Tim. What would you suggest an amateur golfer have if they had one option or the other? An extra club at the top of the set to kind of tighten up those gaps and have gaps in the wedges, or another wedge?
It depends upon the distance gaps in their wedges. So for shorter players that, you know, you're not going to see as big a distance between each the gap of the clubs. Like for high-speed players, you're going to see 14, 13, 15 yards of gap between a gap wedge and a pitching wedge. For a slower-speed player, they may only see 6 or 7. So when you only see 6 or 7-yard gap between a wedge, or I would say the demarcation is about 9 yards. Once you can get actually 9 yards of distance between the wedge, then I think that your loft is proper in that setup. what you may find is using that like 8 to 9 yard distance gap rule, you may find out that you only need 2 wedges in addition to your pitching wedge. You may need a lob wedge and kind of a wedge that is in between a gap wedge and a sand wedge, right? So it's like a 53 or 54 degree and then like a 58 or 59 degree. You may find that that, from a distance perspective, gets you equitable yardage gapping that still meets that 8 yard criteria. And then at that point, you're going to have availability on the top end of set to put other clubs in the bag. So you could put in a 3-wood, a 5-wood, a 7-wood. You could fill up, you know, a bunch of head cover clubs on the top end. So I think that that's really important for the average golfer to understand, is that the set makeups you see up out on tour, those are based upon people that have a lot of speed. And they don't really apply to you. You obviously, most of the golfers out there understand that when it comes to hybrids. But I see so many players with a 3-wood in play that I'll ask them, you know, what do you do with this 3-wood? And they're like, it's like my 220 club, 230 club. And I'm like, that one time, that one golf course with that one swing, right? Because you don't really hit it 230. You hit it 190 most of the time, and then it rolls out to 220. So it's not a usable golf club.
Yeah.
Let's put something else that makes more sense in play. But understanding your set makeup on the top end of the set, understanding that you're going to have to make a sacrifice somewhere with gapping. Usually you're going to choose the top end of the set for that, not the scoring clubs. When you get into super high-speed players, they may not even need a 3-wood. You know, what good is a 3-wood doing you if you're hitting a 320? Like, doesn't do you a lot of good. You'd be probably better off having an extra wedge or two in play, meaning like a 4 or 5 wedge setup. So pay attention to some of those decisions you make, because they can impact your scoring significantly without you even having, you know, without you even needing to know your specs or best components.
This is more of like a course management point, I guess, but for most golfers, if you're 240, it's not like you're trying to attack the pin anyway. You'd almost be better off like laying back and then trying to attack the pin from the fairway.
For the yardage that I think gets a lot of amateurs sideways is like 205 to 220. Over 220, I think a lot of amateurs, like, they swallow their ego and they understand just get it on the front of the green. But when they get into that 200 to 220 range, at least from a lot of amateurs that I play golf with, it's tempting enough to take aim at the flag, but their proficiency and skill set just doesn't dictate they can really pull it off with any level of success.
Yeah.
So that's where I see them waste so many shots. What would be an alternative? Well, just find a golf club that's more forgiving, that helps you hit at 200 yards and just play it to the front of the green at 200 yards. And you're never going to have more than a 20-yard pitch shot, which should be pretty easy to get up and down.
Yep.
But that's, once again, ego getting involved. So,
I mean, you're going to have way more shots like during a round or over the course of a summer from 120 than you are from like 235, where you're trying to knock down the pin.
Yeah, statistically, you would definitely think so. And
yeah,
with in talking about ego, let's get into our gear spotlight for the week. We've got a driver change for Mr. Brooks Koepka.
Ooh, is that an ego transition?
I love his ego. I love how strong it is. I've got nothing. I've got no problem with him being assertive in press conferences. I love it.
Yeah.
But I guess he made a driver change this week. Kind of interesting going into a major, right? Was that the result of a shot that went a little left last week?
Yeah, he missed the drive by like 1 yard, went in the water, cost him the event.
So it was a Maverick in play last week, and now he's got an M5, the old M5, the trusty M5 back in play.
Back to the M5.
Yeah.
He was playing the Callaway Maverick for a while, too.
Yeah, it was pre-corona.
Right? So you got to think that shot had something to do with it, right? Or no? Am I off base?
No,
The fact that it went left, I bet you, yeah, because of the fact that he likes to see it
Turski
go right.
Turski and I talked about this, and, you know, look, I think you can kind of it's a piping hot take, but I mean, it is kind of telling that he used the driver for that long, and he was playing well last week, even before that shot in the water. And then next thing you know, the next time we see Brooks, he shows up with an M5.
Literally the day after.
The next shot he took with the driver, he had the Maverick Sub-Zero out of play.
So here's the question. What are the odds that swing that he took off of that tee was the last swing that he made with that golf club?
He probably snapped that driver in the parking lot. Like even
maybe that's why he's using.
Yeah, right. Even if he planned on using the head again, he was probably like, "Screw this driver." That cost him the tournament.
Yeah,
it cost him like
$1 million miss.
Yeah, like $800,000.
That's $1 million miss.
Yeah,
for sure. So
1 yard.
Yeah,
that's what it looked like. You couldn't really tell from the camera angle, but
anybody that likes to see the ball go right, if they miss a shot of consequence coming down the stretch,
even
left,
a hair left, yeah,
it's done.
Yeah,
like.
That was shocking to see him put that in the water, though.
I see
would
it
be
on the driving
too.
Range. We see this on the driving range. Guy gets up there and just absolutely lasers 9 in a row right at the target. Perfect shape, perfect window. Everything about this golf club, you're like, oh, this is going in the bag. And then one goes left, and then they don't even want to look at it.
Yeah, it's like this club's out. That's how I am with hybrids.
So I'll,
seriously, you hit you that one out of 10 band? Out of bounds left, it's like it's over.
Story time. This is great.
Okay.
You ever hear a focus band? You ever seen one? Daywall, ever
I'm
hear
listening.
Focus band? So it's like a headband, like an 80s style like basketball headband that you put around you, and it's
Wait,
reading
Jason
your brain
Day
waves.
Was using this, right?
Correct. Yes, he was
Jay
using
Day was.
It.
Yeah, okay, I've seen
yeah,
this.
Yeah, yeah.
So focus band. So the idea is it's able to pick up brain stimulation patterns, and it's able to assess whether you're stressed or unstressed. Basically, whether you're in a good mood or bad mood, whatever, anxious, whatever.
Okay.
And so the actual, on the user interface where the headband is linked up to, it reads a color. So if you're green, you're in your little happy place. And if it's red, you're not in a happy place. And it also will, it'll use a tone. So like a pitch tone, like in the tone of the pitch, if it's super high and like loud, high pitched, that means that you're anxious. Mm-hmm. And if it's like this very low, like bass-like tone, it means that you're very peaceful. So we're working with a really good tour player, top five in the world. And going into the fitting, I'm like, is there anything in the bag that needs work? He's like, that 5-wood, mate. That 5-wood just isn't cutting it these days. I'm like, okay. So we're going through, and I'm getting a baseline for gapping. And we're going out on the gapping. And these are like the tightest gapping circles I've ever seen. We're hitting 5 shots, and all 5 shots are literally, if you look at the TrackMan pattern, it's the smallest patterns I've ever seen. And they're exactly 12 yards apart. And so, like, he's got the focus band on the whole time, and it's green. Pitch is good, like... This guy's in a good spot. He takes the utility iron, puts it down. He looks at his bag at the 5-wood, and it just blazes red. Just looking at his 5-wood stressed this guy out so much.
Oh, my God.
He picks the 5-wood up, hits one shot, snap hooks it, literally throws it on the ground, takes the focus band off, has like a temper tantrum, walks around outside for a minute, looks at me, and he goes, hey, I'm never hitting that 5-wood again. And I'm like, listen, man, it's emotional scar tissue. I get it.
Seriously, like, get that club out of the bag.
So this kind of gives you an insight into the way some of these guys are with golf clubs. They're just as crazy as anybody.
Golfers are touchy, man.
And it doesn't matter whether you're number one in the world or whether you're, you know, a weekend warrior shooting 95. You get some bad mojo going with a golf club, you got to get it out of your hands.
We all have that nemesis. That happens on, like, you step up on a golf hole, too, no matter how well you're playing. It's like, this is the hole I always snap
yep.
it out of bounds.
100%, or, and then you know, you do it again.
Something always happens on this hole, and then you make double. It's yeah. like, you know.
So, with that, you know, the really cool thing going into M5 is that injected, you know, twist face that they had. So,
yeah.
The previous iteration of the product before that, they looked at the bulge and roll properties of the face, and they reconfigured that so that you'd have less gear effect result over the shot. Then the next year, going into the M5 product, they started injecting the face, and what that allowed them to do was really tune in. You know, back in the old day, it was COR. Nowadays, it's CT.
CT, yeah.
It really lets them tune in the CT. There was this thing with tour product. How many times did you guys hear this for years with tour product? Well, it's maximum CT. The average golfer thought that having a maxed out CT was going to make them hit it 15 yards further. That's not true, folks. It may make you hit it a half a yard further, but it's not going to make you hit it 15 yards further.
Every little bit counts, though.
But everybody was on the, you know, in this marketplace, the tour-issued marketplace, everybody would value these tour-issued golf clubs. Why? One of the reasons was because they were maxed out for CT so that they would conceivably hit the ball further. Well, Taylor,
it's the magic beans.
What's that?
I said it's the magic beans.
Exactly.
Just,
it's the
you,
magic
you put,
sauce.
You put two,
it's the fairy
you put
dust.
Tour on something and everybody thinks they're going to shoot 65 with it.
It's
or
the
hit it
400
yards.
It's 100%. It's the pixie dust of the industry. The minute you
those
put tour
trucks,
on
they do have the magic beans in there, man.
You do you put limited on it or you put tour issue on it.
That's what hot melt is. That's magic beans.
Yeah, it's the pixie dust. I've heard so many stories about what hot melt does for golf clubs from amateurs. We could get into a whole podcast on it sometime. It's funny. The misconceptions about what hot melt is. But bottom line here, you know, is they started to inject that face. And the idea was to create an illegal face, and then you measure exactly what's going on in the face, and then you inject material in to kind of bring the face back to legal. And the idea here being is it lets you tune in the CT for every single club face that was being produced. An extremely labor-intensive project. I don't know if you guys ever heard or saw the way that they were doing that, where they had a few technicians that literally every single club face that was produced, they'd had a few technicians on CT machines that were all calibrated, and they would be running back and forth between all the machines all day as they test a face, inject it, and retest the face. But, you know, really cool technology that helped TaylorMade tune in how fast their club face was. When you look across the industry, you know, Callaway's got a different play going on with AI-driven flash face, where they have the different variable face thickness throughout the face is kind of asymmetrical. But these are all the things that the manufacturers are doing. Does this speed up the ball speed out of the center of the face? No. It speeds up the ball when you don't hit it in the middle. That's where it really helps.
Which is way more important.
Using variable face. Yeah, which is way more important. That's where you need an enhanced ball speed. So with that, I think we've got a mailbag question this week coming out of Instagram. See, W_Murphy was asking a three-wood question. Wants to know if a three-wood at 13 degrees with a mid-launch shaft or a 15 degree with a low-launch shaft would be a better option, I guess, specifically for him. It's an interesting conversation because the way you fit a three-wood is depending upon the use case. Now, it would be, you know, I wouldn't be able to venture a guess, unfortunately, as far as what would best fit this player because it's so player-dependent. But I would say the starting point would be, what are you using the three-wood for?
Yeah.
Using it off a tee or using it off a fairway? If you're using it off a fairway, predominantly trying to get into greens, I would say going with a 15-degree with a low-launch shaft. I would probably even say a 15-degree with a mid-launch shaft. When you look at tour players, there aren't a lot of them that are using low-launch shafts and fairway woods. Most of them are using... Yeah, exactly. Well, he's different than the rest anyways. But most of them are not using low-launch shafts in their fairway woods, are they, guys? I mean, you see this more prevalently than I did, but
yeah,
most of the fittings I do are mid-launch. With mid-to-high-launch.
Mid-launch seems to be kind of that happy middle area for a lot of tour pros. And even if they're using something that's really tip stiff in their driver, you're right. Mid-launch is what they're looking for because they're trying to bring it in high. Especially if they're trying to attack a par 5 and 2, you're trying to get something that's got a little bit of a higher launch so that you can try and drop it in there.
And even when they're using it off the tee for fairway, you know, for shots into fairways off of tees, they still don't want a lot of run out. The whole reason they're using it is to be able to have the ball hit the fairway and stop and not run through a dog leg or through a slope or something stupid.
Exactly.
So most use cases out on tour dictate a steeper approach, which is going to have more spin, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't see a lot of low launch shafts out there except for the guys that are super high speed. I think that's where you start to see some low launch stuff just because the speed is so high that they create so much lead deflection that they turn that 15 degree into a 20 degree at the end of the day because there's so much lead deflection in the shaft. So they need something that's going to cut down. But unless you're a crazy high-speed player, I mean, with a three-wood, if you're going over 115 with a three-wood, maybe you want to consider a low-launch shaft, especially if your typical launch with a mid-launch shaft is too high. But I wouldn't necessarily go to a low-launch shaft in a three-wood setup. I would pick something that's more mid-launch most of the time. I definitely wouldn't pick a 13 degree with a mid-launch shaft in most cases because, once again, that starting launch angle is going to be a lot lower. Now, if you're using it off of tees, have at it. Play your low-launch shafts. Play your stronger lofted, you know, heads if that's the only place that you're using it. But for most players I know that need to use it where they have a level of control, they don't want a 3-wood that goes 265+. You know, and when you have a 13 degree or a 15 degree with a low launch shaft, you can get those flyers that every once in a while the spin rate is really low and the thing just goes like a driver.
Yeah. Tour players want a range.
I hit this 265, 260 on a cut, 270 on a draw. They don't want this open-ended yardage because that's where they end up over greens, you know, pitching back, you know, down the slopes where it doesn't work from a scoring perspective. So be careful about the way you play your three wood, and the use case is going to guide you as far as what you need. I think that that's always the best way to go, is what do you get on the golf course, and is there a specific, you know, hole that you need to use three woods on, that you need to specifically hit a driving shot? Maybe you need to look at the driver and getting a more accurate driver. And I think that about wraps mailbag for this week. Andrew, excited for the interview?
You know, it's rare when, like, you have such big expectations for something and then it surpasses them.
Yeah.
I thought that's what that Ray Allen interview was like. It was just such an awesome interview. He's a great guy, great guest. And without further ado, I say we just let it run.
And very excited here and fully equipped to have two-time finals champion, 10-time NBA All-Star. Man, this is a lot here, Ray. Olympic gold medalist, all-time NBA three-point king, and NBA Hall of Famer Ray Allen. Ray, welcome to Fully Equipped.
Oh, thanks for having me. You know, you, when you say all those things, all that is just 18 years. If you stay around long enough, you're going to amass some type of credentials.
Still one of the best shooters ever, regardless, though.
That's right. That's right. He can still stroke it with any of them. Absolutely. That's 18 years of showing up, though, like we talked about before we started recording. So, well, we're really happy to have you on. And, you know, for all of our folks out there listening, you're pretty avid golfer. How often are you playing these days?
Right now I'm in Connecticut for the summer, so it's so much easier to play here. It's fascinating because when you're in Connecticut, such a small state, you know, I could be in Rhode Island and Massachusetts within an hour and a half. And then obviously New York is so close. So I get an opportunity to play so much more over the summertime. So I would say I'm playing about 3 to 4 times a week.
Kind of getting into when you first started playing golf, when did you first pick up a golf club and how long did it take for you to get hooked?
I was in college and a bunch of guys, because they noticed that I would come, you know, into the student union, we played pool, and I would dominate pool, and I was good at ping pong, and you know, obviously basketball wasn't that difficult to me in their eyes. So they're like, hey, we got a sport that I bet you can't play. I was like, bring it on. There's nothing, I don't think I couldn't, if I gave my all, I couldn't be good at it. And they're like, oh, well, we're going to play in this golf tournament. Why don't you come through? And so I showed up. No golf clubs. I used their golf clubs, and I could not get the ball off the ground. I knew this was their moment of, you know, getting back at me to show me that, hey, you can't do everything well. And what they didn't realize was they didn't know that I was going to set my intention towards being great at golf, you know, because I don't like the, you know, the feeling that I can't do something, you know, you get challenged. And I just remembered always trying to get better at golf and learning it and paying attention to what I need to do. But it required many years. And I can honestly say that I haven't really had a lesson up to this point, you know, just hitting balls. I'm a student of the game and I watch, you know, a lot of golf on TV, and you just try to incorporate what you see, what you learn. And more importantly, you have to play with better players, and you pick up their idiosyncrasies. You know, the things they do on the golf course, on the green, like how they manage the game. And most importantly, when you play with better players and sometimes older players, you get your good jokes.
Yep, that's exactly right. You know, you just mentioned playing with better players. That's why I got to play with you. I was trying to play with a better player than me. At the time, I think your best was 66. You gone any lower since 66 since the last time we played?
63.
Oh, no way.
When did that happen?
It was 2 summers ago. And, of course, in Massachusetts, I was playing in the tournament. And I just – and what's crazy is it should have been 61.
Oh, my God.
I was hitting the ball everywhere, and I was making putts. I had an eagle, made an eagle on the par 4. It was just a round, one of those rounds that you really, you know, those rounds you play when you feel like you can't make a par. Like you start off, you're like bogey, bogey, bogey. You're like, what is going on? And then it was one of those rounds that I didn't worry about. You just stepped up, hit the ball in the fairway, and you hit it on the green. And for me, if the greens are rolling, I'm such a better putter on faster greens because I'm a lag putter. I hate slower greens where you have to find a line, you have to hit it at that line and hope it goes in.
Yep. For all you folks out there, Ray, his short game is really exceptional, great putter. You know, I think you would probably say that your short game and putting is probably the strongest part of your game.
Well, right now I would not say that. you know, it's like you have these ebbs and flows in your game. Like it's fascinating because Florida is difficult, you know, for chipping because you have it's like four or five different types of grass on a course and then around a green. So the consistency of figuring out what club to hit. Like right now in Connecticut, I'm playing big grass. So, you know, I'll take my 56 or 60 degree around the green, and I know pretty much what the ball is going to do when it comes out of the grass. Down in Florida, you might have Zoysia, you might have St. Augustine, you might have Bermuda. You have so many different strands of grass, and you have to kind of understand them so you know what the ball, how it's going to react. And so, you know, you go down there, you're a couple strokes worse on your chipping. So I haven't had the opportunity to practice as much, you know, my short game. So I actually did a short a putting green in my yard here, and I have like a 75-yard shot. So it allows me to at least practice something when I'm like these times of days. I'd like to get out there and work on my short game.
Yeah.
63 is such a serious number. That's like unfair. I've been playing golf my entire life. You know,
played collegiately.
30 years. He picks it up in college.
Yeah.
And he's already shot a 63.
I'll tell you. Let me add on to that. I think we're happier in life if we limit our expectations. Because I think we think we're supposed to do something or something's supposed to come to us, and when it doesn't, we become disappointed. And so as good golfers that I'm sure all of us are, you expect to hit the ball in the fairway, you expect to hit it on the green, and you expect to make the putt for birdie, but it doesn't always work that way. And so the minute you make that par, you're like, man, that's supposed to be a birdie. And, you know, my father-in-law, he'll hit a banana hook, a banana shot off the tee box into the fairway, and it'll go 230 yards. He'll look at me and he goes, buddy, I couldn't have hit it any better than that. And I'm like, yeah, you actually could have hit it a lot better than that, but he's so excited with that.
I love
it. He's so happy and excited.
Managed expectations.
And yeah, if you manage your expectations, you know, you go out and shoot, you know, 78 tomorrow, and you're like, man, that's 78. I was grinding. I was happy to make that 78. And then kind of, I think when you start with that, you get better, and then your expectations start to lower, and then that's when you start playing better golf.
So if you put me on the line, I would expect to brick it.
Yeah, right.
I can manage my expectations very well if you put me on the line.
While you were actively in the NBA, were you playing a lot of golf at that time, and who were kind of your group of guys that you would go play with, if so?
Well, my first, you know, when I was in Milwaukee, obviously the weather wasn't great in wintertime, but every time we went to Phoenix, we would play golf. We stayed over at the Biltmore. And so we would play the Biltmore, you know, we'd have a day off, and, you know, I played with Del Curry, Vinny Del Negro, Scott Williams. Those were my golfing buddies. And then when I go to Seattle, I don't have any guys on the team that play golf because the team is significantly younger. And so I play with guys, friends of mine around the country that would meet me in Phoenix and we play golf on days off. And then when I got to Boston, I played a lot with Doc Rivers because he loves golf and our equipment manager loved golf and Danny Ainge loved golf. So that typically was always my foursome in Boston. And then in Miami, I'm in Miami. So everybody in Miami golf, you know, if you can't find a game in Miami, then you must be a slow or bad golfer.
I love it. I love it. You know, we've had the pleasure of working with you down at our Doral facility. I know you spent some time with Andy, our club fitter down there, Andy Victoriano. What do you got in the bag right now? And do you have a piece of gear throughout your golfing life that you just love, whether it was a putter or a driver, something that you really loved and maybe wish you didn't get rid of?
Right now I'm playing TaylorMade 790s. I have the Sim driver and Fleetwood, Sim Max.
Yeah.
And I have a 2-iron, Callaway 2-iron that I love that has been good to me. My wedges are TaylorMade, and right now I'm putting with I have a Bettinardi. I've been going back and forth between the Spider, and I have a Bettinardi.
Is that that custom Bettinardi that has all your teams on it
and your logo on it too?
Yeah, I have that one, but the one I've been putting with is kind of like a fluorescent blue color. I forgot the name of it.
Okay.
It's like a half mallet.
Innova. Yeah, probably an Innova. Yeah.
I started putting crosshand about 3 years ago, and I found out that I really love a weighted putter. I try to find a putter as heavy as I can, so I create that pendulum. But to answer your last question, the one piece of golf equipment that I have, I actually didn't give it up, that I love, is I have a Newport 2 Scotty Cameron that it's like gun blue metal.
Mm.
Ooh, so fire.
You actually have to put baby oil on it just to keep it from rusting. Mm. And it's like nice Scotty. Shiny polish.
I love it.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Awesome.
All right, Ray. You can only put one logo on your golf gear. UConn does not count. It's got to be NBA. Which logo are you putting on your golf gear?
Which logo? See, that is a difficult question.
Putting you on fair. Unfair question.
Yeah, it is. Like, if you see my golf bag over the years, it's hard to pay homage to one team because there's always if my golf bag is red, I'll run into somebody from Boston and be like, "Oh, you don't like the Celtics no more." Mm. So if my bag is green, oh, what's the matter? You forgot your time with the Heat.
Ray is franchise agnostic.
Yeah.
It
has to be.
Like, I can't. If I take a picture of something green, it's going to be because most of my career I had a green color in my uniform, so. Until I got to Miami was the first time I didn't have green in my uniform. So it's always interesting because the people who celebrated me over my career, I always have to be respectful of their fandom because they want to be represented all the time because they spent years celebrating and cheering for me. So I try to be more autonomous when it comes to who I choose to represent. So if I pick one, I got to pick all of them.
So I think what he said was the NBA shield. That's what's going on.
Jerry West.
Jerry West goes on. There you go.
I have seen his golf bag. He does have like all four logos on his bag. So got to keep everyone happy. He's also part of the Jordan Brand family. Have you gotten to play much with Michael himself? And do you have any stories that you could share from that?
I played with Jordan, quite a bit. We have played all over the world, obviously being a part of the Jordan Brand. Most summers we have meetings in remote locations. So we have meetings in the morning. There's always golf following. A lot of different places in Mexico, in Florida, in the Bahamas. So I've played, a considerable amount of golf with him. And, he doesn't hit the ball far. But the one thing about him and his game is he knows how to get the ball in the hole. He's probably the best part of his game is his putting. He gets around 10, 12 feet and, he's going to be somewhere around that hole every time.
Mm-hmm. So Ray, as you know, PGA Tour players use customized gear. Is there any piece of gear in basketball that's customized or custom fit for the NBA players?
I would say the shoe more than anything because you have orthotics in the shoe, so you have to get your foot molded. So that's the first thing you do in the preseason is go to the podiatrist and he takes a mold of your foot. So he makes sure that you have orthotics based on, where your arch is, where your comfort level is, and he'll mold them and then he'll bring them to you and then have you try them on and make sure that they feel good. And then you practice with them, and then he'll come back and say, how do they feel, just to make sure. Because so when you see guys play in new shoes, they're actually, the leather is a little bit tighter, but you're putting your orthotics that you've been wearing, so they kind of mold it to your foot anyway.
I've seen some YouTube videos of you showing off your shoe collection. It's absolutely insane. How many shoes are you at right now?
Lost count. I don't even count anymore. You know, they say, you know, I'm taking this class, and this class is this particular subject today I was reading about. It was called The Paradox of Choice. And it was fascinating because it says, we think that choice, having more options, is better for all of us, but it paralyzes us. Mm-hmm. Because too many choices makes us think that, you know, I ultimately end up not making a decision because there's so many things to choose from. You know, think about back in the day when we were growing up, you had three channels. And we just watched, hey, what channel do you want to watch? ABC, NBC, or CBS?
Yep.
Now you're confused because you have so many options, and you ultimately end up saying, you know what, just, I don't know how to choose. Somebody pick it for me. And I think ultimately that's how I am with my tennis shoes. Like, I walk in the closet and I'm like, I just don't know what shoe to wear today, but, you know, let me. and even more so, like, say I want to find a red and black shoe. I have at least 200 pairs of red and black shoes.
I'm like, that is so sick.
Oh, that's outrageous.
He has a lot of, like, you know, personal edition stuff too. I'm like, sure. Highly coveted shoes. It's really amazing.
I'm sure. Yeah. Let's get back into gear before we wrap for this interview, Ray. You know, when did you first get custom fit for a set? I know we've worked with you a few times, as I mentioned earlier. I have to assume that, being a fellow that's much taller in stature than the way that average golf clubs are made, that custom fitting really helped. I know you play a couple inches longer than standard length. So I'd be curious, you know, what you found as far as getting custom fit, how that really helps you dial in your game.
Well, it's fascinating. That's a great question, Tim, because the first time I got custom fitted was when I had Titleist clubs, and I went to a Cushnet over in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I think I had Nike clubs at the time. And you know, you're looking at the loft of your driver, and I'm sitting in there, and they're measuring my clubs. Mm-hmm. And at the time, my loft was like 10.5 degrees. And then when they measured it, it was like 11.2 or something like that. Like, the specs were completely off from what they advertised. And so the average golfer doesn't know any better, so you're not going to ask any questions. You're going to just go with what they give you. I found out that also, because I thought since I was tall, that I needed these big clubs. I needed 2-3 inches over. Mm-hmm. And then I found out that my clubs were too long.
Right.
So then just sitting there and listening to, you know, the fitter fit me and talk about the things about golf, it's so fascinating because you realize, like, it fitting is very important. So when you or any of us has a custom set of clubs, when I'm traveling, lose my clubs or lose my clothes, lose my luggage.
But don't lose your clubs.
But not my golf clubs. because those things take forever to get in, get them custom exactly the way you
want.
Yeah. So, you know, the custom is so important. I always tell people, obviously, when you're just starting, just find a club that you can hit and that you get comfortable with. And then when you start to get good and you understand it, then you get something custom made.
Yeah, I'll always remember looking at Alonzo Mourning's clubs, looking at that 6-iron, and it was like as tall as I was. And I was just going,
pool stick.
What's that?
It's a pool stick.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I've never seen an iron built that long. It actually poses a lot of problems when custom fitting people into that length, because there aren't many iron shafts that are designed to be played that long.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're very limited. You're very limited as far as what products you can even use, because otherwise you have to use extensions, which, you know, it's a whole different story. But Ray,
I'll tell you, let me say one thing about that, though, that's interesting. Most tall players, don't realize that they don't need clubs that long anyway.
Correct.
Because correct. You have long arms. So it's not like you need to bend over as much.
That's exactly right. And especially those, you know, that are good athletes tend to have longer arms than the general population, I would say. And so, you know, we see this a lot out of baseball players, really any athletics, where you have a big, tall person, but they also have very, very long arms. And they don't fit into clubs that are that much longer than standard. I mean, yes, you need stuff that's longer, but it's not as long as you would think proportionately. And right. I've seen it go the other way too, right? I've seen somebody that was shorter statured with short arms actually need to play stuff that was longer than standard. Mm-hmm. So it just speaks to, you know, getting custom fit. If you're going to get out there and enjoy the game to its maximum, I think it's just something that needs to be considered. But Ray, this has been outstanding. Can't thank you enough for spending some time with us on Fully Equipped. Next time I get down in South Florida, I'll look you up. Maybe we can play some golf. And thanks for always supporting us.
Likewise. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks, Ray.
All right.
And many thanks to Ray Allen for coming on Fully Equipped. For all you listeners out there that are looking for more gear content, you can find us on social media. On Twitter, you can find us at @fully_equipped. And on Instagram, we're at @fullyequippedgolf. That's about a wrap for episode 54. Just a reminder for all you folks out there that if you want to come see us at TruSpec, we've got a promotion running through the end of the month, 50% off the fitting of your choice. Just sign up online, www.truespecgolf.com. Use the promo code FE50. Thanks a lot for tuning in. We'll catch you next week.